his bookshop and asked for some love poetry. He didn't have many books left by that time. Folks bought them to burn. And when he finally caught on, he closed his shop for good. So he gave me some fellow named Catullus. He was a Roman. Do you know the kind of things he said in verse? I knew I couldn't say those words to a nice lady. He did anchor after one woman, Lesbia, who spurned him after taking him into her bed. I don't wonder she did so. He did not like it when she petted her downy little sparrow, jealous of a bitty bird he was. He went home and took up his pen to write of his anguish at seeing her cuddle the little birdie to her bosom. He took it hard, and he never liked women after that, and wrote mean poems about them. He was a tight one, too. Do you want to see a poem he wrote when a fallen woman charged him for her favours, poor lass? I will copy it out for you. Is that battered strumpet in her senses who asks me for 1,000 sesterces? That girl with the nasty nose? Ye kinsmen to whom the care of the girl belongs, call together friends and physicians. The girl is insane. She thinks she is pretty. Those are love tokens? I told my friends Eben I never saw such spiteful stuff. He said to me I had just not read the right poets. He took me into his cottage and lent me a little book of his own. It was the poetry of Wilfred Owen. He was an officer in the First World War, and he knew what was what and called it by its right name. I was there, too, at Passchendaele, and I knew what he knew, but I could never put it into words for myself. Well, after that, I thought there might be something to this poetry after all. I began to go to meetings, and I'm glad I did. Else how would I have read the works of William Wordsworth? He would have stayed unknown to me. I learned many of his poems by heart. Anyway, I did win the hand of the widow Hubert, my Nancy. I got her to go for a walk along the cliffs one evening, and I said, "Looky there, Nancy. The gentleness of heaven broods o'er the sea. Listen, the mighty being is awake." She let me kiss her. She is now my wife. Yours truly, Clovis Fawcy. P.S. Mrs. Morgery lent me a book last week. It's called The Oxford Book of Modern Verse, 1892 to 1935. They let a man named Yeats make the choosings. They shouldn't have. Who is he? And what does he know about verse? I hunted all through that book for poems by Wilfred Owen or Siegfried Sassoon. There weren't any, nary a one. And do you know why not? Because this Mr. Yeats said, I deliberately chose not to include any poems from World War One. I have a distaste for them. Passive suffering is not a theme for poetry. Passive suffering? Passive suffering. I nearly seized up. What ailed the man? Lieutenant Owen, he wrote a line, "What passing bells for those who die as cattle? Only the monstrous anger of the guns." What's passive about that, I'd like to know? That's exactly how they do die. I saw it with my own eyes, and I say, to hell with Mr. Yeats. Yours truly, Clovis Fawcy.
From Eben to Juliet. 10th of March, 1946. Dear Miss Ashton, thank you for your letter and your kind questions about my grandson, Eli. He is the child of my daughter, Jane. Jane and her newborn baby died in hospital on the day that the Germans bombed us, the 28th of June, 1940. Eli's father was killed in North Africa in 1942, so I have Eli in my keeping now. Eli left Guernsey on the 20th of June, along with the thousands of babies and school children who were evacuated to England. We knew the Germans were coming, and Jane worried for his safety here. The doctor would not let Jane sail with them, the baby's birth being so close. We did not have any news of the children for 6 months. Then I got a postcard from the Red Cross, saying Eli was well, but not where he was situated. We never knew what towns our children were in, though we prayed not in a big city. An even longer time passed before I could send him a card in return. But I was of two minds about that. I dreaded to tell him that his mother and the baby had died. I hated to think of my boy reading those cold words on the back of a postcard. But I had to do it. And then a second time, after I got word about his father. Eli did not come back until the war was over, and they did send all the children home at once. That was a day! More wonderful even than when the British soldiers came to liberate Guernsey. Eli, he was the first boy down the gangway. He'd grown long legs in 5 years, and I don't think I could have left off hugging him to me if Isola hadn't pushed me a bit so she could hug him herself. I bless God that he was boarded with a farm family in Yorkshire. They were very good to him. Eli gave me a letter they had written for me. It was full of all the things I had missed seeing in his growing up. They told of his schooling, how he helped on the farm, how he tried to be steadfast when he got my postcards. He fishes with me and helps me tend my cow and garden, but carving wood is what he likes best. Dawsey and I are teaching him how to do it. He fashioned a fine snake from a bit of broken fence rail last week, though it's my guess that the broken fence rail was really a rafter from Dawsey's barn. Dawsey just smiled when I asked him of it, but spare wood is hard to find on the island now, as we had to cut down most of the trees, banisters and furniture too, for firewood, when there was no more coal or paraffin left. Eli and I are planting trees on my land now, but it is going to take a long time for them to become grown, and we do all miss the leaves and shade. I will tell you now about our roast pig. The Germans were fussy over farm animals. Pigs and cows were kept strict count of. Guernsey was to feed the German troops stationed here and in France. We ourselves could have the leavings, if there were any. How the Germans did favor bookkeeping! They kept track of every gallon we milked, weighed the cream, recorded every sack of flour. They left the chickens alone for a while. But when feed and scraps became so scarce, they ordered us to kill off the older chickens, so's the good layers could have enough feed to keep on laying eggs. We fishermen had to give them the largest share of our catch. They would meet our boats in the harbor to portion out their share. Early in the occupation, a good many islanders escaped to England in fishing boats. Some drowned, but some made it. So the Germans made a new rule. Any person who had a family member in England would not be allowed in a fishing boat. They were afraid we'd try to escape. Since Eli was somewhere in England, I had to lend out my boat. I went to work in one of Mr. Privet's glasshouses, and after a time I got so I could tend the plants well. But my... Oh, I did miss my boat and the sea. The Germans were especially fractious over meat because they didn't want any to go to the black market instead of feeding their own soldiers. If your sow had a litter, the German agricultural officer would come to your farm, count the babies, give you a birth certificate for each one, and so mark his record book. If a pig died a natural death, you told the A.O., and out he'd come again, look at the dead body and give you a death certificate. They would make surprise visits to your farm, and your number of living pigs had better tally up with their number of living pigs. One pig less and you were fined. One time more, and you could be arrested and sent to jail in St. Peter Port. If too many pigs went missing, the Germans figured you were selling on the black market, and you were sent to a labor camp in Germany. With the Germans, you never knew which way they'd blow. They were a moody people. In the beginning, though, it was easy to fool the agricultural officer and keep a secret live pig for your own use. Here is how Amelia came to have hers. Will Thisby had a sickly pig who died. The A.O. came out and wrote a certificate saying the pig was truly dead and left Will alone to bury the poor animal. But Will didn't. He hied off through the wood with the little body and gave it to Amelia Margery. Amelia hid her own healthy pig and called the A.O., saying, "Come quick, my pig has died." The A.O. came out right away, and, seeing the pig with its toes turned up, never knew it was the same pig he'd seen earlier that morning. He inscribed his dead animal book with one more dead pig. Amelia took the same carcass over to another friend, and he pulled the same trick the next day. We could do this till the pig turned rank. The Germans caught on finally and began to tattoo each pig and cow at birth, so there was no more dead animal switching. But Amelia, with a live, hidden, fat and healthy pig, needed only Dawsey to come kill it quietly. It had to be done quietly because there was a German battery by her farm, and it would not do for the soldiers to hear the pig's death squeal and come running. Pigs have always been drawn to Dawsey. He could come in a barnyard and they would rush up to him and have their backs scratched. They'd set up a shindy for anyone else, squealing, snuffling and plunging about, but Dawsey, he could soothe them down, and he knew just the right spot under their chins to slip his knife in quick. There wasn't time for the pigs to squeal. They'd just slide quietly onto the ground sheet. I told Dawsey they only looked up once in surprise, but he said no. Pigs were bright enough to know betrayal when they met it, and I wasn't to try to pretty matters up. Amelia's pig made us a fine dinner. There were onions and potatoes to fill out the roast. We had almost forgotten how it felt to have full stomachs, but it came back to us. With Amelia's curtains closed against the sight of the German battery, and food and friends at the table, we could make believe that none of it had happened. You are right to call Elizabeth brave. She is that, and always was. She came from London to Guernsey as a little girl, with her mother and Sir Ambrose Ivers. She met my Jane her first summer here when both were 10, and they were ever staunch to one another since then. When Elizabeth came back in the spring of 1940 to close up Sir Ambrose's house, she stayed longer than was safe, because she wanted to stand by Jane. My girl had been feeling poorly since her husband, John, went to England to sign up. That was in December of 1939, and she had a difficult time holding on to the baby till her time could come. Dr. Martin ordered her to bed, so Elizabeth stayed on to keep company with Jane and play with Eli. Nothing Eli liked more than to play with Elizabeth. They were a threat to the furniture, but it was cheerful to hear them laugh. I went over once to collect the two of them for supper, and when I stopped in, there they were, sprawled on a pile of pillows at the foot of the staircase. They had polished Sir Ambrose's fine oak banister and come sailing down three floors. It was Elizabeth who did the needful things to get Eli on the evacuation ship. We islanders were given only one day's notice when the ships were coming from England to take the children away. Elizabeth worked like a whirligig, washing and sewing Eli's clothes and helping him to understand why he could not bring his pet rabbit with him. When we set out for the schoolyard, Jane had to turn away, so as not to show Eli a tearful face at parting. So Elizabeth took him by the hand and said it was good weather for a sea voyage. Even after that, Elizabeth wouldn't leave Guernsey when everyone else was trying to get away. "No," she said, "I'll wait for Jane's baby to come, and when she's fattened up enough, then she and Jane and I will go to London. Then we'll find out where Eli is and go get him." For all her winning ways, Elizabeth was willful. She'd stick out that jaw of hers, and you could see it wasn't any use to argue with her about leaving. Not even when we could all see the smoke coming from Cherbourg, where the French were burning up their fuel tanks, so the Germans couldn't have them. But no matter, Elizabeth wouldn't go without Jane and the baby. I think Sir Ambrose had told her he and one of his yachting friends could sail right into St. Peter Port and take them off Guernsey before the Germans came. To speak the truth, I was glad she did not leave us. She was with me at the hospital when Jane and her new baby died. She sat by Jane, holding on hard to her hand. After Jane died, Elizabeth and me, we stood in the hallway, numb-like and staring out the window. It was then we saw seven German planes come in low over the harbour. They were just on one of the reconnaissance flights, we thought. But then they began dropping bombs. They tumbled down the sky like sticks. We didn't speak, but I know what we each were thinking. Thank God Eli was safely away. Elizabeth stood by Jane and me in the bad time and after. I was not able to stand by Elizabeth, so I thank God her daughter, Kit, is safe and with us, and I pray for Elizabeth to come home soon. I was glad to hear of your friend who was found in Australia. I hope you will correspond with me and Darcy again, as he enjoys to hear from you, such as I do myself. Yours sincerely, Eben Ramsey. From Darcy to Juliet, 12th of March, 1946. Dear Miss Ashton, I am happy you like the white lilacs. I will tell you about Mrs. Dilwyn's soap. Around about the middle of the occupation, soap became scarce. Families were only allowed one tablet per person a month. It was made of some kind of French clay, and lay like a dead thing in the washtub. It made no lather. You just had to scrub and hope it worked. Being clean was hard work, and we had all got used to being more or less dirty, along with our clothes. We were allowed a tiny bit of soap powder for dishes and clothes, but it was a laughable amount. No bubbles there, either. Some of the ladies felt it keenly, and Mrs. Dilwyn was one of those. Before the war, she had bought her dresses in Paris, and those fancy clothes went to ruins faster than the plain kind. One day, Mr. Scope's pig died of milk fever. Since no one dared eat of it, Mr. Scope offered me the carcass. I remembered my mother making soap from fat, so I thought I could try it. It came out looking like frozen dishwater and smelling worse, so I melted it all down and started again. Booker, who had come over to help, suggested paprika for colour and cinnamon for scent. Amelia let us have some of each, and we put it in the mix. When the soap had hardened enough, we cut it into circles with Amelia's biscuit cutter. I wrapped the soap in cheesecloth, Elizabeth tied bows of red yarn, and we gave them as presents to all the ladies at the Society's next meeting. For a week or two, anyway, we looked like respectable folks. I am working several days a week now at the quarry, as well as at the port. Isola thought I looked tired and mixed up a balm for aching muscles. It's named Angel Fingers. Isola has a cough syrup called Devil's Suck, and I pray I'll never need it. Yesterday, Amelia and Kit came over for supper, and we took a blanket down to the beach afterward to watch the moon rise. Kit loves to do that, but she always falls asleep before it is fully risen, and I carry her home to Amelia's house. She is certain she'll be able to stay awake all night, as soon as she's 5. Do you know very much about children? I don't, and although I am learning, I think I am a slow learner. It was much easier before Kit learned to talk, but it was not so much fun. I try to answer her questions, but I am usually behindhand, and she has moved on to a new question before I can answer the first. Also, I don't know enough to please her. I don't know what a mongoose looks like. I like having your letters, but I often feel I don't have any news worth the telling, so it is good to answer your rhetorical questions. Yours, Darcy Adams.
From Adelaide Addison to Juliet, 12th of March, 1946. Dear Miss Ashton, I see you will not be advised by me. I came upon Isola Pribby whilst in her market stall, scribbling a letter in response to a letter from you. I tried to resume my errands calmly, but then I came upon Darcy Adams posting a letter to you. Who will be next, I ask? This is not to be borne, and I seize my pen to stop you. I was not completely candid with you in my last letter. In the interests of delicacy, I drew a veil on the true nature of that group and their founder, Elizabeth McKenna. But now I see that I must reveal all. The Society members have colluded amongst themselves to raise the bastard child of Elizabeth McKenna and her German paramour, Dr. Captain Christian Hellman. Yes, a German soldier. I don't wonder at your shock. Now, I am nothing if not just. I do not say that Elizabeth was what the ruder classes call a jerry-bag, cavorting around Guernsey with any German soldier who could give her gifts. I never saw Elizabeth wearing silk stockings, clad in silk dresses. Indeed, her clothing was as disreputable as ever, smelling of Parisian scent, guzzling chocolates and wine, or smoking cigarettes like other island hussies. But the truth is bad enough. Herewith the sorry facts. In April of 1942, the unwed Elizabeth McKenna gave birth to a baby girl in her own cottage. Eben Ramsay and Isola Pribby were present at the birthing, he to hold the mother's hand, and she to keep the fire going. Amelia Morgery and Dorsey Adams, an unmarried man, for shame, did the actual work of delivering the child before Dr. Martin could arrive. The putative father? Absent. In fact, he had left the island a short time before. Ordered to duty on the continent, so they said. The case is perfectly clear. When the evidence of their illicit connection was irrefutable, Captain Hellman abandoned his mistress and left her to her just deserts. I could have foretold this scandalous outcome. I saw Elizabeth with her lover on several occasions, walking together, deep in talk, gathering nettles for soup or collecting firewood. And once, facing each other, I saw him put his hand on her face and follow her cheekbone down with his thumb. Though I had little hope of success, I knew it was my duty to warn her of the fate that awaited her. I told her she would be cast out of decent society, but she did not heed me. In fact, she laughed. I bore it. Then she told me to get out of her house. I take no pride in my prescience. It would not be Christian. Back to the baby, named Christina, called Kit. A scant year later, Elizabeth, as feckless as ever, committed a criminal act expressly forbidden by the German occupying force. She helped shelter and feed an escaped prisoner of the German army. She was arrested and sentenced to prison on the continent. Mrs. Morgery, at the time of Elizabeth's arrest, took the baby into her home. And since that night, the Literary Society has raised that child as its own, toting her around from house to house in turn. The principal work of the baby's maintenance was undertaken by Amelia Morgery, with other society members taking her out, like a library book, for several weeks at a time. They all dandled the baby, and now that the child can walk, she goes everywhere with one or another of them, holding hands or riding on their shoulders. Such are their standards. You must not glorify such people in the Times. You'll not hear from me again. I have done my best. Let it be on your head. Adelaide Addison.
Cable from Sydney to Juliet. 20th of March, 1946. Dear Juliet, trip home delayed, fell off horse. Broke leg. Piers Nursing. Love, Sydney.
Cable from Juliet to Sydney, 21st of March, 1946. Oh God, which leg? I'm so sorry. Love, Juliet.
Cable from Sydney to Juliet, 22nd of March, 1946. It was the other one. Don't worry. Little pain. Piers, excellent nurse. Love, Sydney.
Cable from Juliet to Sydney, 22nd of March, 1946. So happy it wasn't the one I broke. Can I send anything to help your convalescence? Books, recordings, poker chips, my life's blood?
Cable from Sydney to Juliet, 23rd of March, 1946. No blood, no books, no poker chips. Just keep sending long letters to entertain us. Love, Sydney and Piers.
From Juliet to Sophie, 23rd of March, 1946. Dear Sophie, I only got a cable, so you know more than I do. But whatever the circumstances, it's absolutely ridiculous for you to consider flying off to Australia. What about Alexander? And Dominic? and your lambs, they'll pine away. Stop and think for a moment, and you'll realise why you shouldn't fuss. First off, Piers will take excellent care of Sydney. Second, better Piers than us. Remember what a vile patient Sydney was last time. We should be glad he's thousands of miles away. Third, Sydney has been stretched as tight as a bowstring for years. He needs a rest, and breaking his leg is probably the only way he'll allow himself to take one. Most important of all, Sophie, he doesn't want us there. I'm perfectly certain Sydney would prefer me to write a new book than to appear at his bedside in Australia, so I intend to stay right here in my dreary flat and cast about for a subject. I do have a tiny infant of an idea, much too frail and defenceless to risk describing, even to you. In honour of Sydney's leg, I'm going to coddle it and feed it and see if I can make it grow. Now, about Markham V. Reynolds, Jr. Your questions regarding that gentleman are very delicate, very subtle, very much like being smacked in the head with a mallet. Am I in love with him? What kind of question is that? It's a tuba among the flutes, and I expect better of you. The first rule of snooping is to come at it sideways. When you began writing me dizzy letters about Alexander, I didn't ask if you were in love with him. I asked what his favourite animal was, and your answer told me everything I needed to know about him. How many men would admit that they loved ducks? This brings up an important point. I don't know what Mark's favourite animal is. I doubt it's a duck. Would you care for a few suggestions? You could ask me who his favourite author is. Dos Passos, Hemingway. Or his favourite colour. Blue. Not sure what shade. Probably royal. Is he a good dancer? Yes, far better than I. Never steps on my toes, but doesn't talk or even hum while dancing. Doesn't hum at all, so far as I know. Does he have brothers or sisters? Yes, two older sisters, one married to a sugar baron and the other widowed last year, plus one younger brother, dismissed, with a sneer, as an ass. So, now that I've done all your work for you, perhaps you can answer your own ridiculous question, because I can't. I feel addled around Mark, which might be love, but might not. It certainly isn't restful. I'm rather dreading this evening, for instance. Another dinner party. Very brilliant, with men leaning across the table to make a point, and women gesturing with their cigarette holders. Oh dear, I want to nuzzle into my sofa, but I have to get up and put on an evening dress. Love aside, Mark is a terrible strain on my wardrobe. Now, darling, don't fret about Sydney. He'll be stalking around in no time. Love, Juliet. From Juliet to Dorsey, 25th of March, 1946. Dear Mr. Adams, I have received a long letter, two, in fact, from a Miss Adelaide Addison, warning me not to write about the society in my article. If I do, she will wash her hands of me forever. I will try to bear that affliction with fortitude. She does work up quite a head of steam about jerry bags, doesn't she? I have also had a long letter from Clovis Fossey about poetry, and one from Isola Pribby about the Bronte sisters. Aside from delighting me, they gave me brand new thoughts for my article. Between them, you, Mr. Ramsay, and Mrs. Morgry, Guernsey is virtually writing my article for me. Even Miss Adelaide Addison has done her bit. Defying her will be such a pleasure. I don't know as much about children as I would like to. I am godmother to a wonderful 3-year-old boy named Dominic, the son of my friend Sophie. They live in Scotland, near Oban, and I don't get to see him often. I am always astonished when I do at his increasing personhood. No sooner had I gotten used to carrying about a warm lump of baby than he stopped being one and started scurrying around on his own. I missed 6 months, and lo and behold, he learned how to talk. Now he talks to himself, which I find terribly endearing, since I do too. A mongoose, you may tell Kit, is a weaselly-looking creature with very sharp teeth and a bad temper. It is the only natural enemy of the cobra and is impervious to snake venom. Failing snakes, it snacks on scorpions. Perhaps you could get her one for a pet. Yours, Juliet Ashton. P.S. I had second thoughts about sending this letter. What if Adelaide Addison is a friend of yours? Then I decided no. She couldn't possibly be. So off it goes.
From John Booker to Juliet. 27th of March, 1946. Dear Miss Ashton, Amelia Morgury has asked me to write to you, for I am a founding member of the Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society, though I only read one book over and over. It was The Letters of Seneca, translated from Latin in one volume, with appendix. Seneca and the society, betwixt them, kept me from the direful life of a drunk. From 1940 to 1944, I pretended to the German authorities that I was Lord Tobias Penn-Piers, my former employer, who had fled to England in a frenzy when Guernsey was bombed. I was his valet, and I stayed. My true name is John Booker, and I was born and bred in London. With the others, I was caught out after curfew on the night of the pig roast. I can't remember it with any clarity. I expect I was tipsy, because I usually was. I recall soldiers shouting and waving guns about, and Dawsey holding me upright. Then came Elizabeth's voice. She was talking about books. I couldn't fathom why. After that, Dawsey was pulling me through a pasture at great speed, and then I fell into bed. That's all. But you want to know about the influence of books on my life, and as I've said, there was only one. Seneca. Do you know who he was? He was a Roman philosopher who wrote letters to imaginary friends telling them how to behave for the rest of their lives. Maybe that sounds dull, but the letters aren't. They're witty. I think you learn more if you're laughing at the same time. It seems to me that his words travel well, to all men in all times. I will give you a living sample. Take the Luftwaffe and their hairdos. During the Blitz, the Luftwaffe took off from Guernsey and joined in with the big bombers on the way to London. They only flew at night, so their days were their own, to spend in St. Peter Port as they liked. And how did they spend them? In beauty parlours, having their nails buffed, their faces massaged, their eyebrows shaped, their hair waved and coiffed. When I saw them in their hairnets walking five abreast down the street, elbowing islanders off the sidewalk, I thought of Seneca's words about the Praetorian Guard. He'd written, "Who of these would not rather see Rome disordered than his hair?" I will tell you how I came to pretend to be my former employer. Lord Tobias wanted to sit out the war in a safe place, so he purchased La Fort Manor on Guernsey. He had spent World War I in the Caribbean, but had suffered greatly from prickly heat there. In the spring of 1940, he moved to La Fort with most of his possessions, including Lady Tobias. Chauzy, his London butler, had locked himself in the pantry and refused to come. So I, his valet, came in Chauzy's stead, to supervise the placing of his furniture, the hanging of his draperies, the polishing of his silver, and the stocking of his wine cellar. It was there I bedded each bottle, gentle as a baby to its crib, in its little rack. Just as the last picture was being hung on the wall, the German planes flew over and bombed St. Peter Port. Lord Tobias, panicking at all the racket, called the captain of his yacht and ordered him to red up the ship. We were to load the boat with his silver, his paintings, his bibelots, and, if enough room, Lady Tobias, and set sail at once for England. I was the last one up the gangway with Lord Tobias screaming, "Hurry up, man, hurry up, the Huns are coming." My true destiny struck me in that moment, Miss Ashton. I still had the key to his lordship's wine cellar. I thought of all those bottles of wine, champagne, brandy, cognac, that didn't make it back to the yacht, and me all alone amongst them. I thought of no more bells, of no more livery, of no more Lord Tobias. In fact, of no more being in service at all. I turned my back on him and quickly walked back down the gangway. I ran up the road to La Forte and watched the yacht sail away, Lord Tobias still screaming. Then I went inside, laid a fire, and stepped down to the wine cellar. I took down a bottle of claret and drew my first cork. I let the wine breathe. Then I returned to the library, sipped, and began to read The Wine Lover's Companion. I read about grapes, tended the garden, slept in silk pajamas, and drank wine. And so it went until September, when Amelia Morgury and Elizabeth McKenna came to call on me. Elizabeth I knew slightly. She and I had chatted several times among the market stalls, but Mrs. Morgury was a stranger to me. Were they going to turn me into the constable? I wondered. No, they were there to warn me. The Commandant of Guernsey had ordered all Jews to report to the Grange Lodge Hotel and register. According to the Commandant, our ID cards would merely be marked Juden, and then we were free to go home. Elizabeth knew my mother was Jewish. I had mentioned it once. They had come to tell me that I must not, under any circumstances, go to the Grange Lodge Hotel. But that wasn't all. Elizabeth had considered my predicament thoroughly, more thoroughly than I, and made a plan. Since all islanders were to have identity cards anyway, why couldn't I declare myself to be Lord Tobias Penn Piers himself? I could claim that, as a visitor, all my documents had been left behind in my London bank. Amelia was sure Mr. Dilwyn would be happy to back up my impersonation, and he was. He and Amelia went with me to the Commandant's office, and we all swore that I was Lord Tobias Penn Piers. It was Elizabeth who came up with the finishing touch. The Germans were taking over all of Guernsey's grand houses for their officers to live in, and they would never ignore such a residence as La Forte. It was too good to miss. And when they came, I must be ready for them as Lord Tobias Penn Piers. I must look like a lord at leisure and act at my ease. I was terrified. "Nonsense," said Elizabeth. "You have presence, Booker. You're tall, dark, handsome, and all valets know how to look down their noses." She decided that she would quickly paint my portrait as a 16th-century Penn Piers. So I posed as such in a velvet cloak and ruff, seated against a background of dark tapestries and dim shadows, fingering my dagger. I looked noble, aggrieved, and treasonous. It was a brilliant stroke, for not 2 weeks later, a body of German officers, six in all, appeared in my library without knocking. I received them there, sipping a Chateau Margaux 93, and bearing an uncanny resemblance to the portrait of my ancestor hanging above me over the mantel. They bowed to me and were all politeness, which did not prevent them from taking over the house and moving me into the gatekeeper's cottage the very next day. Eben and Dorsey slipped over after curfew that night and helped me carry most of the wine down to the cottage, where we cleverly hid it behind the woodpile, down the well, up the chimney, under a haystack, and above the rafters. But even with all this toting of bottles, I still ran out of wine by early 1941, a sad day. But I had friends to help distract me, and then I found Seneca. I came to love our book meetings. They helped to make the occupation bearable. Some of their books sounded fine, but I stayed true to Seneca. I came to feel that he was talking to me in his funny, biting way, but talking to me alone. His letters helped to keep me alive in what was to come later. I still go to all our society meetings. Everyone is sick of Seneca, and they are begging me to read someone else, but I'll not do it. I also act in plays that one of our repertory companies puts on. Impersonating Lord Tobias gave me a taste for acting, And besides that, I am tall, loud, and can be heard in the last row. I am happy the war is over, and I am John Booker again. Yours truly, John Booker.
From Juliet to Sydney and Piers, 31st of March, 1946. Mr. Sydney Stark, Monregal Hotel, Broadmeadows Avenue, 79, Melbourne, Victoria, Australia. Dear Sydney and Piers, no life's blood, just sprained thumbs from copying out the enclosed letters from my new friends on Guernsey. I love their letters, and could not bear the thought of sending the originals to the bottom of the earth, where they would undoubtedly be eaten by wild dogs. I knew the Germans occupied the Channel Islands, but I barely gave them a thought during the war. I have since scoured the Times for articles and anything I can cull from the London Library on the occupation. I also need to find a good travel book on Guernsey, one with descriptions, not timetables and hotel recommendations, to give me the feel of the island. Quite apart from my interest in their interest in reading, I have fallen in love with two men, Eben Ramsay and Dorsey Adams. Clovis Fossey and John Booker I like. I want Amelia Morgry to adopt me, and me, I want to adopt Isola Privy. I will leave you to discern my feelings for Adelaide Addison, Miss, by reading her letters. The truth is, I am living more in Guernsey than I am in London at the moment. I pretend work with one ear cocked for the sound of the post dropping in the box. And when I hear it, I scramble down the stairs, breathless for the next piece of the story. This must be how people felt when they gathered around the publisher's door to seize the latest instalment of David Copperfield as it came off the printing press. I know you're going to love the letters too, but would you be interested in more? To me, these people and their wartime experiences are fascinating and moving. Do you agree? Do you think there could be a book here? Don't be polite. I want your opinion. Both of your opinions, unvarnished. And you needn't worry. I'll continue to send you copies of the letters, even if you don't want me to write a book about Guernsey. I am, mostly, above petty vengeance. Since I have sacrificed my thumbs for your amusement, you should send me one of Piers's latest in return. So glad you are writing again, my dear. My love to you both, Juliet.
From Darcy to Juliet, the 2nd of April 1946. Dear Miss Ashton, having fun is the biggest sin in Adelaide Addison's Bible, lack of humility following close on its heels, and I'm not surprised she wrote to you about jerry bags. Adelaide lives on her wrath. There were few eligible men left in Guernsey, and certainly no one exciting. Many of us were tired, scruffy, worried, ragged, shoeless, and dirty. We were defeated and looked it. We didn't have the energy, time, or money left over for fun. Guernsey men had no glamour, and the German soldiers did. They were, according to a friend of mine, tall, blonde, handsome, and tanned, like gods. They gave lavish parties, were jolly and zestful company, possessed cars, had money, and could dance all night long. But some of the girls who dated soldiers gave the cigarettes to their fathers and the bread to their families. They would come home from parties with rolls, pâtés, fruit, meat patties, and jellies stuffed in their purses, and their families would have a full meal the next day. I don't think some islanders ever credited the boredom of those years as a reason to befriend the enemy. Boredom is a powerful reason, and the prospect of fun is a powerful draw, especially when you are young. There were many folks who would have no dealings with the Germans. If you said so much as good morning, you were abetting the enemy, according to their way of thinking. But circumstances were such that I could not abide by that with Captain Christian Hellmann, a doctor in the occupation forces, and my good friend. In late 1941, there wasn't any salt on the island, and none was coming to us from France. Root vegetables and soups are listless without salt, so the Germans got the idea of using seawater to supply it. They carried it up from the bay and poured it into a big tanker set in the middle of St. Peter Port. Everyone was to walk to town, fill up their buckets, and carry them home again. Then we were to boil the water away and use the sludge in the bottom of the pan as salt. That plan failed. There wasn't enough wood to waste, building up a fire hot enough to boil the pot of water dry. So we decided to cook all our vegetables in the seawater itself. That worked well enough for flavor, but there were many older people who couldn't make the walk into town or haul heavy buckets home. No one had much strength left over for such chores. I have a slight limp from a badly set leg, and though it kept me from army service, it has never been bad enough to bother me. I was very hale, and so I began to deliver water around to some cottages. I traded an extra spade and some twine for Madame Lapelle's old baby pram, and Mr. Soames gave me two small oak wine casks, each with a spigot. I sawed off the barrel tops to make movable lids and fitted them into my pram. So now I had transport. Several of the beaches weren't mined, and it was an easy thing to climb down the rocks, fill a cask with seawater, and tote it back up. The November wind is bleak, and one day my hands were near numb after I climbed up from the bay with the first barrel of water. I was standing by my pram, trying to limber up my fingers, when Christian drove by. He stopped his car, backed up, and asked if I wanted any help. I said no, but he got out of his car anyway and helped me lift the barrel into my pram. Then, without a word, he went down the cliff with me to help with the second barrel. I hadn't noticed that he had a stiff shoulder and arm, but between those, my limp and the loose scree, we slipped coming back up and fell against the hillside, losing our grip on the barrel. It tumbled down, splintered against the rocks, and soaked us. God knows why it struck us both as funny, but it did. We sagged against the cliffside, unable to stop laughing. That was when Elia's essays slipped from my pocket, and Christian picked it up, sopping wet. "Ah, Charles Lamb," he said, and handed it to me. He was not a man to mind a little damp. My surprise must have showed, because he added, "I read him often at home. I envy you your portable library." We climbed back up to his car. He wanted to know if I could find another barrel. I said I could and explained my water delivery route. He nodded and I started out with my pram. But then I turned back and said, "You can borrow the book, if you'd like to." You would have thought I was giving him the moon. We exchanged names and shook hands. After that he would often help me carry up water, and then he'd offer a cigarette, and we'd stand in the road and talk. About Guernsey's beauty, about history, about books, about farming. But never about the present time. Always things far away from the war. Once, as we were standing, Elizabeth rattled up the road on her bicycle. She had been on nursing duty all that day, and probably most of the night before. And like the rest of us, her clothes were more patches than cloth. But Christian, he broke off in mid-sentence to watch her coming. Elizabeth drew up to us and stopped. Neither said a word, but I saw their faces, and I left as soon as I could. I hadn't realized they knew each other. Christian had been a field surgeon until his shoulder wound sent him from Eastern Europe to Guernsey. In early 1942, he was ordered to a hospital in Caen. His ship was sunk by Allied bombers, and he was drowned. Dr. Lorenz, the head of the German occupation hospital, knew we were friends and came to tell me of his death. He meant for me to tell Elizabeth, so I did. The way that Christian and I met may have been unusual, but our friendship was not. I'm sure many islanders grew to be friends with some of the soldiers. But sometimes I think of Charles Lamb and marvel that a man born in 1775 enabled me to make two such friends as you and Christian. Yours, Dawsey Adams.
From Juliet to Amelia, 4th of April, 1946. Dear Mrs. Morgry, the sun is out for the first time in months, and if I stand on my chair and crane my neck, I can see it sparkling on the river. I'm averting my eyes from the mounds of rubble across the street and pretending London is beautiful again. I've received a sad letter from Dawsey Adams, telling me about Christian Hellman, his kindness, and his death. The war goes on and on, doesn't it? Such a good life, lost. And what a grievous blow it must have been to Elizabeth. I am thankful she had you, Mr. Ramsay, Isola, and Dorsey to help when she had her baby. Spring is nearly here. I'm almost warm in my puddle of sunshine. And down the street, I'm not averting my eyes now, a man in a patched jumper is painting the door to his house sky blue. Two small boys, who have been walloping one another with sticks, are begging him to let them help. He is giving them a tiny brush apiece. So, perhaps there is an end to war. Yours, Juliet Ashton.
From Mark to Juliet, April 5th, 1946. Dear Juliet, you're being elusive and I don't like it. I don't want to see the play with someone else. I want to go with you. In fact, I don't give a damn about the play. I'm only trying to rout you out of that apartment. Dinner, tea, cocktails, boating, dancing, you choose, and I'll obey. I'm rarely so docile. Don't throw away this opportunity to improve my character. Yours, Mark.
From Juliet to Mark. Dear Mark, do you want to come to the British Museum with me? I've got an appointment in the reading room at 2 o'clock. We can look at the mummies afterward. Juliet.
From Mark to Juliet. To hell with the reading room and the mummies. Come have lunch with me. Mark.
From Juliet to Mark. You consider that docile? Juliet.
From Mark to Juliet. To hell with docile. M.
From Will Thisbe to Juliet, the 7th of April, 1946. Dear Miss Ashton, I am a member of the Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society. I am an antiquarian ironmonger, though it pleases some to call me a rag and bone man. I also invent labour-saving devices, my latest being an electric clothespin that wafts the laundry gently on the breeze, saving the laundress's wrists. Did I find solace in reading? Yes, but not at first. I'd just go and eat my pie in quietude in a corner. Then Isola got a hold of me and said I had to read a book and talk about it like the others did. She gave me a book called Past and Present by Thomas Carlyle, and a tedious thing he was. He gave me shooting pains in my head, until I came to a bit on religion. I was not a religious man, though not for want of trying. Off I'd go, like a bee among blossoms, from church to chapel to church again, but I was never able to get a grip on faith, till Mr. Carlyle posed religion to me in a different way. He was walking among the ruins of the abbey at Bury St. Edmunds, when a thought came to him, and he wrote it down thus, "Does it ever give thee pause that men used to have a soul, not by hearsay alone, or as a figure of speech, but as a truth that they knew and acted upon? Verily it was another world then, but yet it is a pity we have lost the tidings of our souls. We shall have to go in search of them again, or worse, in all ways shall befall us." Isn't that something? To know your own soul by hearsay, instead of its own tidings. Why should I let a preacher tell me if I had one or not? If I could believe I had a soul all by myself, then I could listen to its tidings all by myself. I gave my talk on Mr. Carlyle to the society, and it stirred up a great argument about the soul. Yes? No? Maybe? Dr. Stubbins yelled the loudest, and soon everyone stopped arguing and listened to him. Thompson Stubbins is a man of long, deep thoughts. He was a psychiatrist in London until he ran amok at the annual dinner of the Friends of Sigmund Freud Society in 1934. He told me the whole tale once. The Friends were great talkers, and their speeches went on for hours, while the plates stayed bare. Finally they served up, and silence fell upon the hall as the psychiatrists bolted their chops. Thompson saw his chance. He beat his spoon upon his glass,
and shouted from the floor to be heard. "Did any of you ever think that along about the time the notion of a soul gave out, Freud popped up with the ego to take its place? The timing of the man! Did he not pause to reflect? Irresponsible old coot! It is my belief that men must spout this twaddle about egos because they fear they have no soul. Think upon it." Thompson was barred from their doors forever, and he moved to Guernsey to grow vegetables. Sometimes he rides with me in my cart, and we talk about man and God and all the in-between. I would have missed all this if I had not belonged to the Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society. Tell me, Miss Ashton, what are your views on the matter? Isola thinks you should come to visit Guernsey, and if you do, you could ride in my cart with us. I'd bring a cushion. Best wishes for your continued health and happiness. Will Thisbe.
From Mrs. Clara Saucy to Juliet, 8th of April, 1946. Dear Miss Ashton, I've heard about you. I once belonged to that literary society, though I'll wager none of them ever told you about me. I didn't read from any book by a dead writer, no. I read from a work I wrote myself, my book of cookery recipes. I venture to say my book caused more tears and sorrow than anything Charles Dickens ever wrote. I chose to read about the correct way to roast a sucking pig. Butter its little body, I said. Let the juices run down and cause the fire to sizzle. The way I read it, you could smell the pig roasting, hear its flesh crackle. I spoke of my 5-layer cakes, using a dozen eggs, my sponge sugar sweets, chocolate rum balls, sponge cakes with pots of cream, cakes made with good white flour, not that cracked grain and birdseed stuff we were using at the time. Well, miss, my audience couldn't stand it. They was pushed over the edge, hearing of my tasty recipes. Isola Pribby, that never had a manner to call her own, she cried out I was tormenting her, and she was going to hex my saucepans. Will Thisbe said I would burn like my cherries jubilee. Then Thompson Stubbins swore at me, and it took both Dawsey and Eben to get me away safely. Eben called the next day to apologize for the society's bad manners. He asked me to remember that most of them had come to the meeting directly from a supper of turnip soup, with nary a bone in it to give pith, or parboiled potatoes scorched on a hot iron, there being no cooking fat to fry them up in. He asked me to be tolerant and forgive them. Well, I'll not do it. They called me bad names. There wasn't a one of them who truly loved literature, because that's what my cookery book was, sheer poetry in a pan. I believe they was made so bored, what with the curfew and other nasty Nazi laws, they only wanted an excuse to get out of an evening, and reading is what they chose. I want the truth of them told in your story. They'd never have touched a book, but for the occupation. I stand by what I say, and you can quote me direct. My name is Clara Saucy. S-A-U-S-S-E-Y. Three S's in all. Clara Saucy. Mrs.
From Amelia to Juliet. 10th of April, 1946. My dear Juliet, I too have felt that the war goes on and on. When my son Ian died at El Alamein, side by side with Eli's father John, visitors offering their condolences, thinking to comfort me, said, "Life goes on." What nonsense, I thought. Of course it doesn't. It's death that goes on. Ian is dead now, and will be dead tomorrow, and next year, and forever. There's no end to that. But perhaps there will be an end to the sorrow of it. Sorrow has rushed over the world like the waters of the deluge, and it will take time to recede. But already there are small islands of hope, happiness, Something like them, at any rate. I like the picture of you standing